Welcome. Thank you for joining us. So today is Thursday, April 11th, 2019, and it's 4:30. This is panel 3605, entitled Design Thinking for the Next Century. It's a pleasure to be with you all here today. My name is Madeline Gonzalez-Allen. I'm a consultant with IBM. I helped start the first design thinking chapter in Colorado, and also am initiating bringing design thinking to this awesome University of Colorado institution. I'm an advisor and mentor with several amazing startup accelerator programs here in Colorado, and I'm in the process of co-founding my own startup, focusing on sustainability innovation. And today we have an amazing panel to introduce to you, and some of them you may have already heard along the week. First, starting, we switch the order, with Moses Ma. Moses designed two of the world's best-selling computer games. He helped to develop internet standards with some of the fine folks at IBM, apparently. He invented the term e-markets and started a dot-com called BizBots. He currently runs Future Lab, which is a blockchain lab, and is a partner at Next Generation Ventures, which is a spunky little venture accelerator. Welcome, Moses.
Thank you.
And next we have Joe Toscano. He is a former experienced design consultant for Google. He's won international awards for his work, and since leaving Google, Joe has been focusing on bringing technology literacy to the masses. Thank you. Including speaking and consulting around the world. Joe is the author of Automating Humanity, and I look forward to hearing more about that later today, and founder of Beacon, Better Ethics and Consumer Outcomes Network. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you.
And lastly here is Layla Ajarolu.
That was good. I'm giving you an 8.
Woo! A sustainability provocateur, love it, who's challenging all of us to look differently about how the world works. She's an award-winning designer, United Nations Environment Program Champion of the Earth, and she developed the disruptive design method. Her main stage TED Talk on sustainability has been viewed over a million times, and she gave a pretty good keynote for CWA this week.
You guys did all the work, so it's true. You're a very nice audience.
Welcome, Layla, to the panel. So for those who haven't been to a panel format like this before, first each speaker will be invited to give opening statements, and then we're going to invite the speakers to respond to each other's opening statements, and then we look forward to opening it up to the broader audience for conversation and discussion with you all. And the format, thank you, Yvonne, is going to be, if you have questions you want to be maybe thinking about asking, you'll be able to ask them through our app, the CWA app, or you can also write them down on note cards, and we have very helpful producers who are available to come over to you with the note card and, I believe, a pen or a pencil, too. All right. So let's get started. Moses.
Hi, everybody. So I am from Silicon Valley, where we believe in interactivity. So instead of just talking to you, I'd like to interact a little. The first thing yes, you can hear me? Can you hear me all right? The what? Yes. Sorry. Is it better now? Thank you for interacting. So to be interactive, let's do three little exercises. First one is on social networking. Please shake hands with someone in a different role. And then trade business cards, say hi.
Wow.
Okay, that's enough. That's enough of that. All right, so the next exercise. The next exercise is
hello.
Look at me, kids. The next exercise, we're going to do a wave because I've always wanted to videotape one. When I say go, the front row, just put up your hands and put it down and then have the wave propagate. All right? One, two, wait. Okay, one, two.
Hey! Wow, that looks so cool.
Okay, one more time, except we're going to have to bounce off the back and come from the front. And everyone scream when it happens.
Get some flow. Get some flow into it.
Okay, one, two, three, go!
There we go.
Okay, it's coming backwards. It's coming forward.
Come back, come back,
much for that. And the third thing is, I invite you to bring your phones out and try to text while I talk. Because I actually use this as a device to see if I'm being boring or not. All right? So in Silicon Valley, we're not afraid of technology. We invite you to bring this out and start texting. And I'll try to keep you from texting. All right? All right. So what I want to talk about is not design thinking, but design feeling. So one of my very first projects, I teamed up with Michael Berry at Stanford, who developed all of these techniques. And we went into a very large bank. And they said, we'd like to learn what it is you do to come up with kind of interesting products. I said, well, it's called ethnography. And this is before design thinking was the big term. And they said, OK, we'll give you a bunch of money. Please build one of these divisions in our bank. So we built one. And what we did is we taught bankers empathy, which was like a really, you know, wild idea back then. We said, and at that time we talked about observation and interviewing skills. So we said, don't tell them what to do, don't try to sell them anything. Just go there and try to expand your ability to see. And then see with your heart and actually feel what they're saying. And then the second thing we do is when we interview, we have kind of a, like an appreciative inquiry about their lives, like we actually care. And it worked, you know. So the division did very well for a while. And Paul Kazarian was the fellow I trained, and he started doing this. And then one day, after about a year of doing these workshops, they would go out and camp out with a customer, just to hear them, their stories, to understand who they were. And then the vice president of sales for the bank came in and said, I have a question. He says, yes, that company over there, what did you do to them? I said, we do this thing called ethnography, you know, design thinking kind of stuff. So we go in and we listen, we're kind of empathetic. And he said, well, how did you sell them the treasury management product? And he said, well, we looked at their flows and we realized they could really use it. So he said, hey, you should look at the treasury management product, and they bought it. They said, and the vice president said, we've been trying to sell that for 5 years. And you managed to close a deal that we couldn't. And I'm now realizing that whatever it is you're doing, you should teach the entire sales force whatever this thing is. And he said, it's empathy. He says, wow, we need to learn this thing and learn how to take that. So the impact of this was they started doing this, and they immediately started closing deals they hadn't closed before because they stopped selling. And they just started listening and caring, right? And then... For the customer, it felt like, it isn't that you're trying to sell me anything. You really want to know who I am and how to help me. And the end result was that we charged them less than $250,000 for the entire project. And they have been making $20 million a year in unrealizable sales using these techniques. They would send in the empathy team, right, to close these deals. So if anyone ever asks you what the value of empathy is, you just tell them $20 million a year. So I'd like to talk about expanding design thinking into design feeling, design seeing, design hearing, right? And it's all about expanding who you are as well as being more connected. So the other thing I want to say about design thinking...
How much more time?
You're good.
Okay, so... design thinking is actually an incredibly powerful weapon that could be used for good or evil. So if you design products like Cambridge Analytica did, you know, you can actually do things with it that are very powerful. One of the things I actually am kind of concerned about is how friendly Siri sounds. And then when you're driving and, you know, and Google is telling you which way to turn, all of you, how many will do whatever Google says when you're driving?
Yeah.
Yeah. You're being taught how to obey your robot overlords, right? So I actually think that when you do the design thinking, you build this really, you know, juicy interface, and people love it, you got to sit and think, am I really doing the right thing? Maybe I should do an interface that says, you know, I could tell you how to get there, but I want you to get smarter. Why don't you just take it from here for a few blocks, and then I'll come back and help you in a minute. Why not, right? So if you think about it, what's happening in the world today is our flat screens are getting flatter, and we're all getting fatter, and our intelligence is getting, artificials, devices are getting more intelligent, and humans are actually getting stupider. Right, so that's not what we want. We actually want to use these tools that we've developed to create human beings that are the best versions of themselves, which is completely different from how surveillance capitalism and other kinds of things happen. Like, if you put the best possible AI into traffic light cameras and then organize them to find out everywhere you've possibly run a red light and they start tracking you, that's not fun, right? And if you think about it, the movie that we're living is like, the Truman Show, right? But if you're living in Afghanistan, it's Terminator. Not Terminator. Yeah, Terminator 3, where they're, robots are coming to kill you. So that's what I wanted to say about design thinking.
Thank you.
Joe? My turn. Okay, I'm going to start probably a little bit less interactivity, but first question for everyone. How many of you came to this talk because you are a bit terrified about where the future is headed with technology? That's a lot less people than I expected, considering we're in Boulder. But yeah, okay, cool. So she mentioned my book, Automating Humanity, and my company, Beacon. The big reason why I am doing this stuff is, like she said, literacy for the public. But because I was consulting for Google out in the valley, and I saw things while I was doing that concerned me. And not just within Google. That's what a lot of people ask me, like, oh, you're going to tell me all the secrets about Google and how evil they are? No, I'm not.
And NDA.
Yeah, exactly. That's part of it. But also, I don't think that any of these companies are inherently evil. I've met a lot of people that work in the companies. I know a lot of people very well in these companies, and they're good people. But some things that I try to express and bring to life for the public especially is that there's certain things that are hard to understand unless you're inside working on these projects. And I try to bring those to life for people to say, it's different when you are working to make the impossible possible and asked to do it tomorrow. And you have $1 billion budget pointed at it. That's not to make an excuse, but to say that coming back to design thinking, there are ways that we need to start to rethink things with the human in mind. And there are ways that we can do that in business savvy ways as well. So my company, the Better Ethics and Consumer Outcomes Network, is focused on not ethics for the sake of humanity, although that is a good foundation that we need to start with, but figuring out how we begin to put this into the language of business, because these businesses have the rights of an individual in many senses, but they don't have the heart and the soul of a human. And so we need to speak their language if we want to start changing it. So I'm really excited to be on this design thinking panel to discuss some of these issues at large and how we can begin to wrap our minds around turning it into a more human-friendly business system as a whole, right? One thing that I talk to a lot of companies about, the way that they're innovating right now, where it's move fast and break things and the speed at which we're moving. If you think about smart investment models, a very, very safe bet that you can look at is the forestry industry, right? This last years, people invest in the forestry industry not because they're going to get a return tomorrow, but because it's going to be a steady income for the rest of their lives generally. The forestry industry, though, could make a lot of money really fast if they just cut down all the trees and sold all those trees real fast. The way that we are moving forward in technology, we're cutting down our trees by disabling our people through mental instability, through physical problems and our postural deformities from all the devices we're being glued to. And this is science we can talk about if you want to. Destroying our communities, the way that we communicate and inform each other, actively participate. So that's something that I go to these companies with when I give talks all around the globe is, look, you can focus on your quarterly revenue now, but you won't have it in a few years if you continue at this pace. I'm really excited to be here. Thank you all for having me, and I'm excited to hear what we discuss over the next 45 minutes.
Thank you, Joe. Layla?
Well, I am definitely not of the same cornucopian ilk as my fellow panelists. Cornucopian theories that technology will save us all. I am very much more connected to the biological systems that sustain every single one of us and every single human that's ever been and will ever come, even if they do become cyborgs. They still need to breathe. So I personally think that technology is a tool like anything else, like money, like power, that can be used or abused, okay? So you can serve someone or you can stalk them with technology, and right now we're all being stalked, as we know. And this in itself presents a whole conundrum of ethical questions that my panelists posed. And I think what's really fascinating is just we get, you know, any system, you get what you put into it, right? So if you're going to bake a cake and you accidentally put in salt instead of sugar, it's going to taste like shit. And I feel like that's what happens, right? The people who are hired, who are given the tools in order to do this, I'm trying to say a big word and my brain is homogeneous. Say it for me.
Homogeneous.
70% white men are employed at Google, to the point where when Siri was first coded, she didn't know how to respond to the question of what to do when you are sexually assaulted. There was a huge controversy when you typed in "women should" into Google and the auto response said, "shut up." It's been changed. So for me, you get what you put into a system. And as long as we have such inequity with regards to employment opportunities, in regards to diversity, not just gender, but also cultural worldviews and countries and life experiences, then we're going to keep having these same stalkery, abusive, and not very emotionally intelligent machines dictating our lives. I mean, I've only ever had a fight with any of those machines, which is basically just my personal, like, Alexa, play me jazz. And she plays something really bad. I'm like, I don't like that jazz. I want better jazz. And she's like, I can't help you. I'm like, when you can argue back, then I will have you in my house. I don't want to, you know, anyway. So I could go on a long rant about this. Yeah, well, it's... But there's a lot of really incredible defectors, tech defectors, like my colleague sitting here, who, I think I said this in my keynote, people, it's dark design, dark patterning, we're all being
cognitively manipulated.
Thank you. We could do this as a tag team. This is great. It's like a fill in the blanks. It's like that activity I tried to do with you and I got it all wrong. So yeah, we're being cognitively, and essentially that is very by design. It's incredibly intentional. And a lot of people who are working at this then later kind of wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat going, what the ever am I doing? I'm using my smarts and my capabilities to manipulate people who I care about to buy things or do things that they don't want, which is then turning around and affecting our whole political system and our whole culture. Because you know what? Democracy wasn't built with technology. And the internet has only been around for a very short period of time. And ethics and morality and social change requires conversations where everybody has a seat at the table to talk about what kind of future we want to have. And right now, not everybody is being able to do that. And I just went on a rant about that. But I don't know how many more minutes I have, but I had one other point to make about empathy. As a sociologist, meaning I was trained in the field of human social research, I have a huge problem with extractionary research. When I studied social science and I wanted to interview any of you, I had to get ethics clearance. Who knows what ethics clearance is? Good, I'm glad you do. Ethics clearance is basically what was set up after a significant amount of human-based research experiments that manipulated and tragically hurt people, like Stanley Milgram's experiments and the Stanford Prison experiment, which then turned around and said, you know what, actually, we need to make sure that our researchers have adequately thought through all of the potential harmful outcomes that me interviewing or experimenting on you is going to have, so that when I write my questions or when I sit with you, I'm doing it with the most ethical and positively intentional interaction. But nowadays we have a bunch of tech people running around asking people why they do things and what their motivations are without considering the impact of that, because research is change. You change someone when you ask them questions. You know, when I did my PhD, I had three people who tried to quit their design jobs because they felt so guilty about what they had learned. And I was like, no, don't. Stay in your jobs. We need people. But this made me extremely aware of the power of what I was doing as a researcher. So for me personally, ethics isn't just about what we create, it's what we do. And this is something that is fundamental to humanity's success, is to make sure that our moral codes of conduct are replicated they evolve in a way that means that we're always doing better and not going backwards. So yeah, I'm all for compassion first before empathy.
Absolutely. Thank you. Well said.
You're getting me late in the afternoon. That's when I get very fiery.
This is without coffee.
I had a lot of M&Ms because I was really tired. This is sugar. This is what sugar does to me.
Thank you. Very well said. So now we have the opportunity for you all to respond to some of what each other has said.
Can I spin on that real fast, actually? Because that's a big reason why I'm doing what I'm doing, too. When I was in college, I also was doing a lot of research. I decided not to go PhD route, but instead to go the applied route and start to build technologies and participate in what is now the largest social experiment in human history. I find it ironic, though. She talked about the ethics that was created after, like, the Stanford Prison Experiment. And if you've heard of it, or if you haven't heard of it, basically it was an experiment to see what power was like between human beings and how they would interact if they were just given the appropriate roles and uniforms, really. And it ended up being a huge abuse of human rights, right? It's looked back in psychology as one of the largest. I think it's ironic that nowadays we're working with technologies out in California where the persuasive computing lab, which it also happens to be from Stanford, is the root of a lot of the problems that we have nowadays in technology. I think that we will look back very similarly on the actions of the modern Stanford experiment and say that this actually is the largest abuse of human rights in human history.
Wow.
Okay, I'll respond by just admitting I'm a Pollyanna, right? So the data that I look at is worldwide poverty is at the lowest it's ever been. It's gone from 35% in extreme poverty to under 7%. The number of people who've died in wars in the last 60 years has dropped from 15 per 100,000 to less than one. Global literacy has gone from 35% to 85% in the last 60 years. I actually see the big picture as humanity actually moving into a new phase of collective intelligence, or what I call coagulated consciousness. So coagulation is this biological term for when single-cell organisms become multi-cell organisms. And I think that human beings are doing that right now through the internet and through other methods. So I actually feel a lot of hope about the world, but maybe I should just, like, hang out with you guys.
Well, it's funny because I am actually extremely optimistic about the future, and all of the metrics of human development in the last 20 to 30 years are demonstrating, you know, we've decreased malnutrition globally, but we increased obesity. So whilst one metric goes down and we can cherry pick which ones we look at, we see others going up, like air pollution, 9 million people every year. Associated illnesses. One of the second biggest killer in the world is loneliness and associated issues with loneliness. So I think that whilst, of course, humans have done an incredible job, and I think technology has been amazing at elevating our species to this position where we have figured out how to, like, bridge. You know, when I was a kid, I went to this technology museum, was really into it. I studied product design. I wanted to be a designer. I wanted to do this stuff. And then I had a moment where I realized that everything was interconnected and that I was going to be responsible for potentially making decisions that would have far-reaching catastrophic impacts that I would have no idea about because I wasn't being given the tools to make sure that the decisions I made weren't negatively going to impact the people around me or the planet. So anyway, the point that I forgot what I was going to say. Before I said that, what did I say? Little, what? Oh, the museum. Okay, back there was this museum called the Powerhouse Museum, and it was an amazing museum to go to as a kid. It had all these interactive exhibitions, and it was all about technology in the future. And they had this pole, and on one side there was a telephone, and on the other side another telephone, and you could video call the person on the other side, which was like literally a wire. And I remember thinking, it's going to be so crazy in the future if you can video call people. And like every time I get on any device now and I video call people, I remember my like 8-year-old self going, this is crazy. Like I live in the future. I live in the future and I'm part of the future and it's ubiquitous and it's normal. And there's people in this room who probably never had a time when the telephone was connected by a wire and you couldn't leave your house with it. You know, you just sit by it for a very long time waiting for people to call. So, you know, I mean, on one hand, it's incredible, it's amazing, it's magic, look at us. We should be very proud of ourselves in some respects, but on others, we're really failing. Like, the cost of our development is the systems that sustain us Like, that's the tragedy. We do not value the things that will give us the ability to go even further and be even greater. So what I'm more interested in is not the delusion that technology will save us and be the sole savior of our species, but how we can take all the technology, both the physical technology of what we've learned to make with our hands and the stuff that we've learned to make with our minds, and we apply that to being a regenerative force on this planet, a force that doesn't just extract and exploit, but gives back more than we take. Imagine that. That would be an incredible legacy to have achieved as the greatest experiment of life in the known universe.
You need to eat M&M's more. Yeah. Yeah, I also have a lot of hope. That's the reason why I am doing what I'm doing. I wouldn't be doing it if I thought there was no hope. I would be in the company and I would be taking my salary. But
eating those coconuts in the middle of winter that they give you at lunchtime to keep you happy and placated.
Yeah, no.
I love going to Google because I get to eat like I'm like on a tropical island.
Yeah. It's great. It's great. Yeah. But and now I don't have a home. I travel around the world, and I don't get any of those. So it's okay. I believe in what I'm doing, and I am very passionate about it. I also think technology has improved our lives in so many ways. Even a simple thing like Google Maps, right? How many of you remember in 2001 when Google Earth came out as something you plug into your computer, your desktop, and it shut it down? Right? Yeah? Still does? Yeah. Yeah. Somebody needs an upgrade. I have a Google Pixel 2 now. And, well, it's not now because I lost it in Brazil. But I did. And in the background of my phone, on the wallpaper, is a rendering of Earth. It has lightning strikes. It has cloud patterns. And it's the wallpaper on my phone. That's crazy, right? What, 18, 19 years later? And then when it gets into like mapping, I mean, it's safety for society. It's not always the most beautiful thing, right? I wish Google Maps had it. Let's take the scenic route. They don't, but you can share your location with people. You can be safer in many ways. However, as we've kind of mentioned here already, I just think there's fundamental issues that need to be altered. Some of that I think is going to require regulation. The big reason why I'm starting Beacon and have written the book is that I would like to keep it more informal regulation. I think that there are certain things that right now it's hard to press on from a legal perspective because we don't fully know. And if we lace it down in law, that could not only be a threat to innovation, which obviously is a problem, but it could also become a threat to national security in many ways if we're not innovating and keeping up. I work really hard to bring these issues to life in a way that the communities can discuss, people can discuss, and they are literate about. Yep. And then people can push on companies from the outside and demand more of them in a reasonable manner, while we as consultants work from the inside to push things and ask questions as regulators that are informing things as opposed to inflaming them. So I do have a lot of hope, but it is going to take a lot of work from all of us collectively.
For sure.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for sharing. And we're starting to get some great questions. Please keep them coming. You can send them through the app, or we have
you can use that technology,
producers.
Or you can use the analog one. Make your pick.
We will not hold it against you, though. Shall we not hold it against them?
I didn't insinuate I would.
For this particular context. Thank you very much. All right. And by the way, if you're a student, please indicate that on your question so we can be prioritizing the student questions. Okay. So, awesome, you guys. Some good questions in response to this. Okay. So, Moses.
Yes.
Get ready for this one.
Okay. It's directed at you, Moses.
Yeah. Did the empathy training change the people?
Yes.
They probably would like a little more detail than that.
I'm trying to think of an example. One of the areas where I don't see change in America is polarization. So I personally, when I hear that there's a potential client who is a big-time Republican donor, I'll immediately go and give them a discount and do whatever it takes to meet with them and talk to them. So one story I'll share with you about changing people is she's like one of the biggest donors to the Republican Party. And when I went to her 35,000-acre ranch to consult, the first thing she said is, "You're a liberal. I'm not going to talk to you until you shoot some guns." And they took me out to the gun range. And She actually had a beautiful gun range, had never shot skeet before, and she had an Olympic coach, right? So I said, this is a great opportunity. I shot every single one of those clay pigeons, right? And the guy said, you're actually good at this. You should consider doing this. I said, that's enough. So when he told her that I could shoot, she said, I'll listen. And the very first words out of her mouth were, you know, what do you think about immigration? You know, isn't that the worst problem we have in America? And what I said wasn't an argument. I said, do you like Apple Computer? And she goes, yeah, it's a great American company. I said, yeah. You know, Steve Jobs' father was a Syrian refugee. If we did then what we're doing now, Apple would belong to Germany or to China. And she said, okay, I'll give you that one. Okay. So you can't win by arguing and polarizing. You actually have to go and meet with them and talk to them. I really like Bill Maher. You guys ever watch him?
Yeah.
So he's like constantly telling the candidates to go on Fox News. And I think that's what all of us have to do. And when someone actually gets very angry, my favorite line to a Republican who would heckle me is, I don't know you, but I love you. Okay? That's Pollyanna enough for me. Does that answer the question about change?
Okay. It's a great answer. I don't know if it answered the particular question, but it was a great answer for sure.
He's been hanging out with politicians.
Thank you, Moses. So I'm seeing a couple of questions on the same theme here, really around how do we inspire people to take morality and ethics seriously and or to be able to actually do something about the morality and the ethics that we understand are vital, given that the companies or the government or whatever the institution they're part of may not be able to or willing to or able to tackle it.
You take that one.
Okay. Yeah, I was waiting for you to tell me to go. Yeah, this is my daily. So great question, whoever brought that up. It's a huge challenge, right? Because ethics, for the most part, is put in the realm of philosophy or theory, right? And to bring it into a business, it's not easy. So part of that is doing the research. It is, you know, I have a human behavior background. I know where a lot of that research exists or where to find it, who to talk to. So that helps us as a company to get the numbers to sell to companies. But I think larger than that, and the reason why I'm so focused on literacy, is I think it comes down to working with the market and educating consumers so they can demand more appropriately. Because right now, like, I'm from Nebraska. If you guys don't know where that is, it's right next to Colorado. I didn't bring any steaks with me, but I know that people probably wouldn't want them here anyway. So I'm from Nebraska. When the Trump election happened, it was really troubling for me. I don't care your political perspective. You can vote for who you want. But it was tough because I'm sitting in San Francisco, which is the farthest left you can get. And I have all my friends and family back home, which is about the farthest right you can get or, you know, around there. When the election happened, I took the time to really sit down and talk to people to say, like, what were you thinking? In a very polite way, you know, like, but I wanted to understand because, like he's mentioned, you don't make change by yelling at people and telling them what to think. You listen. And what I heard from a lot of my friends and family actually was fear of the future, right? What did Trump sell? He sold Make America Great Again. Now, did he follow his promises? That's a whole separate conversation, but what he sold touched their soul. Right, and it touched what they wanted in life. And that is really why we make decisions a lot of times in life. We're irrational human beings, no matter how much we want to rationalize ourselves. And so I talked to them, and really in realizing that, it was, we need to leave and educate people about this stuff because sometimes they don't even realize what's happening out there, right? Like, I remember in 2017, I went home to go teach a class at the University of Nebraska, and when I got lunch, I used Apple Pay. They thought I was stealing because they didn't see that I didn't use a credit card. I used my phone. It's just a matter of literacy, right? Imagine in the 1400s when the printing press came out that if you couldn't read, I could pass a note to Moses. You, if you were illiterate, could open it up and it would be scribbles. What's happening on the internet is a new literacy, a data and technology literacy. And where I'm from, there are a lot of people who are illiterate. It doesn't make them dumb, right? If I ask someone in Silicon Valley to help me change a tire, they're going to call a professional. But if I talk to my parents who own a body shop and didn't go to college, how to change a computer, they're going to do the same. You know, it's just different ways of life, and that's what makes the world go round. So I think actually the biggest proponent in getting this change to happen is to educate communities, and then for those people who are educated to start talking to your neighbors, talk to your friends, help them understand this stuff, because we can't just depend on thought leaders or the media to do this. We all need to work together, and we need to have empathy for the other side so we can have those conversations and not yell at each other.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well said. So a couple of questions, again, on a different theme, actually the theme of the topic of this panel, and two of them from a student, two students. So one kind of emphatically, just to share, this is what happens when we get to use a note card, the emphasis, but design thinking does not equal technology. What is your definition of design thinking, the process of the human mind that informs resultant processes and products? So that's one of the parts of the question. And then the other is, can they explain a little about what is design thinking and how does this, do big companies like Google and IBM, how are they applying it basically in their industries? I'm a student.
I'll start.
Yeah, I'll feed up.
Yeah, design thinking is basically invented around Stanford. And so you should assume that all the big companies are using it. It used to be a secret weapon, but everyone's doing it now. What it is being able to see what's in plain sight that people can't see. That's what design, they call it, tacit design or seeing unarticulated requirements and things like that. It's talking to people and seeing what they're doing and seeing that their behavior doesn't match what they're saying. So what they're doing doesn't match what they're saying. They're saying, I really want this, but they're actually doing something else. That divergence lets you go, what's actually going on? And then you unpack it psychologically to understand what they really want, and that usually gives you a great product. Go ahead.
Where's the M&Ms?
So many words all coming at once. So that's one of the tools of design thinking, which is this empathy, asking questions. And basically the history is that there was some social researchers working in some design processes, and they realized that there was a good synergy between them. And as a designer and a sociologist, I'm all for the synergy of these two things. Design thinking is a process of synthesizing the more complex design process. Is there any designers in the room? Architects, product designers, graphic designers. So you guys would know when you go to design school, whatever flavor of design school you go to, fashion design, there's like a bunch of different professional design practices. You develop your own design process, right? You learn a bunch of tools and then you apply that to creatively solving complex problems, whether it be material problems or visual problems, doesn't matter. But you develop your own process. So design thinking is like a kind of what's that cream you get when you spray it? It's like whip. It's the in the oh, that's a terrible analogy. It's like the easy version of a complex problem solving process. And that's not to say it's bad. That's just to say it's a way of approaching the world to solve a problem, often in a business context, by running through a creative thinking tool set, using particular gleaned tools such as questioning and empathy, such as post-it notes. I always make a joke saying I think IDEO was hired by 3M when they came up with design thinking, because I got to tell you, there's a lot of post-it notes in design thinking. So it's an interesting tool, and it's very powerful, as you said. It's very powerful because you learn things, insights, you glean information from the deep psychological weirdness of humans, and you can then use that to sell people stuff, like $20 million worth of banking products, which in this country I worry about because the banking sector hasn't been the most ethical. So for me, it's a very interesting tool. And it has power, and it's very powerful because design is basically one of the biggest social scripters that we have in the world around us, and it influences us both cognitively and also subconsciously. So I feel like design thinking is like the technology thing. It's exactly the same. Like it is a technology because technology doesn't just have to be tech. Humans have been, you know, figuring out how to form materials to make the world work for them. The first Stone Age, you know, was to figure out how to actually... What do they do with stones in the Stone Age anyway? Just clubber things to death? Just like, okay. And then they figured out sharp things, and that got better. But so nonetheless, what I'm trying to say is that I think that it's like the same technology debate. There's positives and it's all about the use. It's any tool, it's about who uses it and how it's used. And design thinking is a process. There are 5 stages. You go through it, and I think, who knows them off the top of their head? Go. 5 stages of design thinking. Go.
Empathy.
No, that's one of them. That's the third one.
That's the heart of it for me.
The end is prototyping. The beginning is exploration. And then there's ideation. There's 5 stages. You go through it. You iterate. You basically come up with a concept at the end of it that should fit the problem that you started with. That tends to be the case. And in the middle, you ask people a bunch of questions, and then you sell them something they may or may not need as a result.
Mm-hmm. It's basically the scientific method with some business application.
So let me ask something for the student who asked the question. It's like a method for finding the aha that will make your product more successful. That's like the easy way to say it. It's actually like any other pursuit in life. There's like an entire lifetime of study that goes into it. But the simplified way of thinking about it for a student is that it's a technique, like doing scales on a piano. You learn it, and then you can actually build better products.
I know I've already sucked up a lot of time, but can I give you one example where I think this is really poignant? Okay, so after Sandy, it hit New York, right? Obama made a fund, a design thinking fund, like a research fund, to figure out how to protect New York from future Sandys. And one of the solution that received the money, was a very kind of linear result. And it's an interesting idea. It's basically build some walls in the ocean to prevent it. The one that didn't win, that didn't take the same approach to getting to the solution, is, in my opinion, one of the most fascinating and important ideas for coastal regions, and that was reforesting the ocean with oysters, because oysters operate they disseminate the force, and New York used to have quadrillions, I think actually quadrillions, I'm not just exaggerating, of oysters. In fact, oysters were so cheap that it was completely exploited by the early settlers. So you have this amazing natural biological intervention that has multiple benefits, because oysters also clean water, and I don't know if you guys have been to New York lately, but that's still not the cleanest place in the world. And so there's like multiple layers of benefits, but because it wasn't this very linear, clear-cut, simple solution, it didn't get the funding and the support. And for me, that's really the difference. Use the design thinking, kind of like follow this process, versus use systems thinking and really look at the biological and human interface, and then you can come up with truly progressive. And just in case you're interested, there is this really cool project called the 1 Billion Oyster Project, where they are teaching kids and they're seeding oysters in the Hudson River in New York. So they're still doing it on their own bat, which I think is really cool.
Let me add that this topic was about design thinking in the next century. Actually, I think design thinking itself is evolving very rapidly, mm-hmm. and it's a beautiful thing to learn. I think that it should be taught in elementary school as a root. So it's a great thing to learn.
Thank you. There are so many great questions, and we're just not going to have time, but I want to thank you all for all the awesome questions, and we'll try to get to as many of them as possible here. From another, a design student. Do you think the trend of using more and more tech in design is ethical to consumers, humanity in general, or should we try to move away from unneeded tech?
Good question. I think that could be considered a design thinking problem in itself, right? Tech for tech's sake, I'm not a huge fan of it, but also people are going to try things, and it's up to the consumers whether it ends up working ultimately. And I guess if you have a big bank account, you can push it. But I don't know. I think the reason why I got into technology, I know the reason I got into technology was to help people get away from screens and actually to just create utility. I think that what we're seeing, especially a lot out in Silicon Valley right now, is like, let's work as much as possible to get people glued. But there's also a lot of ethical issues we have to consider if we're going to create technologies that get us away from screens, right? All of my awards have been in the conversational design space. So like your Alexa and your Google Home, those kind of things is where I've won my awards. But also, like mentioned earlier, it gets creepy when Siri is so comfortable with you, right? There's also like the fact of if you create a conversational interface for Google Search, which is all Assistant is, that's the future of Google Search, then you're going to reduce the amount of results. So we're going to cut off the long tail of the internet in many ways. You're not going to get 6 million results. You're going to get
bad jazz.
3 to 6 bad jazz results. And how do you balance those, right? Because it will either have to be hyper-personalized to each individual, which separates us and fragments us even more, or it will have to be whatever is generic and fits their business model for advertising revenue. There's probably some in-betweens there too, but not a lot. So, it's going to be a conversation that we're going to have as designers for the rest of our lives. And it's a great question. I can't give you a prescriptive answer because there is not one. But my opinion is hopefully we start to get away from screens and use tools as utilities to help us move forward.
Yay.
You know, I have a design problem I've been working on. I thought I'd share it with you and see if you guys had any ideas. But it's a really good example of how designers think in terms of things that will change the world. So how many of you have heard of blockchains? Yeah. Okay, so you can do these things called tokens, and you give people tokens that are behavioral, and it'll incent them to do things. So one of the projects my partners and I are working on is we'd like to build an entire city based on blockchains. So that's why we go hunting for billionaires and say, would you like to build a city ground up, doing it the right way? And one of the thoughts we had initially was, maybe we can give tokens to people for doing good things to improve the community. Like if you figure out how to do childcare better or create a network that finds better childcare resources, that should be rewarded with a token. So we were like really happy, and then suddenly China announced that they were doing the same thing in the city, but they had a social goodness token. And basically, they were giving tokens for being a good citizen, you know, and informing on your bad neighbors. And then if you don't meet a certain threshold, you can't travel. They take away your right to travel. But if you get enough points, they'll give you business class for free, right? And then all I thought was, man, that is creepy, right? So what is that fine line between what will really build a better world and what's creepy? So these are, like, really interesting design issues that we're facing, and I thought maybe we could turn that. Does anyone have an idea for how do you make a non-creepy social reward system? Just don't do it.
I think we already have social rewards for a lot of our stuff. It's just they're becoming more formalized and turned into currency, like that we recognize as currency. I don't know. I think about that a lot. You know, the balance of that is going to be difficult, and if you want to create a currency for our attention, you're going to have to track a lot of things. We're going to have to clean the data. Whose data is worth more versus whose is less? How do you determine that? That's why I have concerns with blockchain and some of the stuff. I see the value in it in many ways, don't get me wrong. But also I think that it's going to be a while because we have to get the adoption from the masses to get those things to happen. And I think those conversations are going to be really hard to have, especially right now in the current climate. So, I don't know, man. I think it's tough on that one.
Children respond much better to positive reinforcement.
Very good point.
Yeah.
Make it positive rather than
there's a lady there.
I think we already use rewards like get your 10th drink free if you buy 9, and they're very like local and like, specific to your lifestyle.
Yeah.
I think that's the way they're not creepy. It's just being
like...
Well, okay. So we already built a reward system. It's called money.
Yeah.
But so we're socialized to respond to reward and punishment. That's the whole social construct of humanity.
Yeah.
And what you're talking about is called gamification, using game mechanics in non-gaming environments. And the reason it works is because of game theory, which is the economic theory of how agents or actors operate in a given environment to maximize their... I'm sorry, sometimes I get so nerdy. To maximize their efficiency or efficacy. Like, you and I are playing games all the time, over whether it be power, or whether it be success, or whether it be love or affection. affection or romance, you know, that is basically what economists study. And then on the other side, you have the technology sector or social designers. Like, as a designer, I try to design interventions that support social change, right? That's ethical and that has those kinds of outcomes. So we already have all of this stuff. It's built into our social conditioning to respond to reward and punishment. When you were a kid, you got ice creams for being good, and you got sent to the naughty corner for being bad. And we replicate that. That's what we do. I have a nephew, and when he was naughty, he was so naughty, and I was like, stop it, stop it. And then I was like, yo, go to the naughty corner. And I was like, how does my house have a naughty corner? Like, where did that come from? And it just was because that's what I heard other people with kids trying to not kill them do, you know? So, you know, it's a social replication. That's what we are. We're social animals. We follow those around us. So I'm not saying good or bad. I'm just kind of layering the nerdville over here on why and how this does and doesn't work.
Yeah.
We have to wrap this one up. Yeah.
So I have business cards. If you have some ideas for how to do this in a human way, please come up. I'll give you a card. I'd be happy to be friends and enter a dialogue with you about it.
Great.
Put one last.
We do need
that.
To wrap this one up.
Yeah, yeah. So the last thing on that I want to say is, like, people talk to me a lot about the manipulative design patterns that are going on in Silicon Valley, how we need to regulate them, et cetera. And there is new regulation that's just getting spoken about as of the past couple days. But something else to think about is that the addictive patterns that are created in the applications are the same things that your personal trainer does to get you to get in shape. The difference is the scale
and a slot machine.
Yeah, and a slot machine, which
because
we regulate.
Because continuous scroll, I'm addicted to continuous scroll. I have a problem. Yeah. I don't have it on my phone because I will waste hours of my life.
Yes.
Cha-ching!
Same. But I think that a lot of it has to do with the scale and the anonymity of it, you know?
Yeah.
The nuances are lost, and they're generic to the point where we are trained into the generic as opposed to nuanced as humans. So.
Okay, wait,
and they're out of context. We all need to move on.
Forward.
I know this one we can do. How about after the panel, anyone who's interested, we can continue this particular topic. Okay. So, Layla, question.
Oh, I thought we were ending.
No. We have about 9 minutes. I'm asked to keep this to the time so people have time to get to the next one, apparently. But this one's for you. And back to the earlier comment, you value the importance of natural circular growth and emphasize that it's vital for regenerative change. As a biologist, I agree with you. And this, by the way, is also a student. However, I wonder how we can disrupt the human-made circles, destructive as they are in our societies. Artificial circles may be more difficult to break than wasteless, fragile, natural ones.
Oof. I hope you're old enough to drink whiskey. It would really help.
I'm glad this one's for you.
It's my solution to most of these kinds of existential crisis problems. Okay, so let's just get something straight. Nature is way stronger than us. We are a product of nature. We were born out of some magic soup of magicness. It really is. Like, there's not one single other known life force in the entire infinite universe. And here we are with words and technology. You know, we can speak to the dead and listen to the future. Other way around, Layla. Speak to the future and listen to the dead. God, I'm really good at messing up my great lines this whilst at the Conference of World Affairs. Because that's what we've developed. Like, the first and most amazing technology he mentioned, the printing press. Like, this is incredible. So we have this incredible opportunity to realize that we are using the materials that we see around us. We're already mimicking nature to create things that better ourselves. So it's built into our DNA. And I was on an amazing panel earlier with an indigenous woman, and she was talking very profoundly. If anyone was in the room, my mind was changed like 4 times on that panel, because she kept reminding us of like her intimate connection with natural systems because of the lessons she learned from the respect that she has for her culture and her elders. And when she learned how to collect salmon based on the temperature of the water and the relationship to the world, that is like 50, 60 years ago. We were still at least partly responsible. On my farm, I've learned how to make everything from scratch. I never farmed anything in my life, and it's like magic. If you grow something from I thank you for filling in the blanks, but that one was intentional. I was just demonstrating how profound it was. I was speechless. So I think to answer your question, you know, we need to disrupt the unsustainable elements of our society. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Buckminster Fuller, and he always says that in order to make change, you don't invest your energy in fighting the existing system. You design a new system that makes the old one obsolete. Okay? Because if you get caught up fighting the system, you're sucked into what already exists and you replicate it. Instead, you should be at the edge where you are in that beautiful, uncomfortable zone of possibility, fear, and opportunity. And with enough knowledge, creativity, collaboration, and potential, we can really push the edge, and it's happening. We're talking about hope, man. I've been working in this space for longer than you think, because I look younger than I actually am. Thank you. But it surprises me who is calling me and being all like, Layla, you need to come and tell our company how to stop destroying the planet. It's happening, and it's happening not just because of the fact that people are waking up to the responsibility of their actions. It's happening because we have like limited resources on the planet, and it's becoming obvious that the impacts are greater than the opportunities that exploitation offers us. So I do truly believe that we with the right focus, energy, and charisma, will be able to transition these systems, because we've done it many times before, and I think we'll have the potential to do it into the future.
Beautiful. Would you like to comment on that? Okay. Yeah, just one last question from the audience, and then maybe if you want to have closing comments. And this is an awesome one too. Please speak to the idea of synergizing all of you thought leaders here together into a cross-fertilizing network to build on all your ideas together.
There's a systems thinker out there. Synergize. What's the universal element? What's the one word that defines all the things that we've been talking about? Don't you think it's ethics? Oh. Okay, sustainability, ethics, empathy.
Here, I want to do stuff with you. Let's connect.
He's got synergy. No, he's got strategy on his card. Well, how would you answer this?
That's difficult. Can you repeat the question? I'm thinking of it. I just need to hear it again.
I think part of this question and possibly implied is they'd like to be part of it too. So we're offering up so much here, thought.
Yeah.
And so what can be a synergizing of the thought leadership here and also inclusive, right, of the thought leadership that's out there and moving forward together?
Just because we're on a stage doesn't mean that we have any greater capacity to make an impact in the world. So I just want to say that.
Yeah.
I'm just buying him time, basically.
I'm trying to help him here.
He's like, I don't know.
Okay, it's a tough question, right? Like, how do we synergistically work? I mean, we do every day. That's what I can tell you. We do every day. It's a matter of your choice whether you're going to participate or not. But whether you do or not, it still happens.
So I'll take that one as the panel moderator to see what we can do through the conference and what we can do to facilitate more of an ongoing dialogue.
I heard there's this thing called the internet. It helps people from many different places connect.
For that.
Let's make a Facebook group.
You have video calls now.
Beautiful. Okay, would you each like a couple of moments for closing comments?
I think I've said so many words. It's been a pleasure. You guys are awesome. You should give yourself a round of applause. I've had a lot of fun with you all. So thank you, Boulder, for being so interesting. Austin gets that weird thing. I think Boulder should get that as well. A little bit weird in a great way.
Sure.
So I will just say that this conversation is not to be held on this table. And as you walk out the room and you go, that was interesting. Oh, I learned some things. I think the most important thing is as you walk out the room, you should eyeball a stranger, which is creepy, I know, but you're all friends now. And you should take 2 minutes to answer the question of what can you do right now within your sphere of influence, within the agency that you hold as an individual, no matter how much money you have or how much influence you have in your job. What is the thing that you can do that will help make change, but not just in your life, but in the immediate world around you? Because I guarantee you that all the talking in the world will not change the world. It's actions. And unless we all start taking micro or macro actions, nothing will ever change. So that is my challenge to you guys. And then you can come and tell me what ideas you came up with. So thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Lynn.
She stole mine.
Because we're synergizing up here.
Yeah. We've
got one brain, one world. Yeah. Oh, Jesus, that's so stupid.
No, I'm going to say something very similar, though. I end all of my talks with a challenge to everyone, which is to create that future, right? You came to this talk, to this conference at large, to learn something and to leave a better person, or I hope you did. If you didn't, then I'm just putting words in your mouth. But you have more knowledge now. You've heard us talk. You've heard the other panelists talk. Begin to become more active in your communities. Begin to talk to the other side and help bridge the gap. Leave Boulder once in a while. Get out of the bubble, you know. So that's my challenge to you is we are active participants. Let's actually build the future that we want to be a part of, not just scream about it on social media.
Oof. Snap. Yeah.